Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 528. My name is Minter Dial and I'm your host for this podcast, an ever proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information or to check out other shows on this wonderful network, go and visit evergreenpodcast.com. So before introducing my guest, I'd like to give a quick shout out and thanks for putting up a 5-star review of the show on Apple Podcasts by Barish Serafshoy. So this week's interview is with Ray Shanahan. Ray is the CEO at InnovationWorks and Chief Strategy Officer at Business Solver, Business Administration Technology. At InnovationWorks, Ray and her team support incubating new business strategies and opportunities, focused on delivering delight to their clients and their employees. In this conversation with Ray, we discuss some of the key findings in the new Business Solver 2023 State of Workplace Empathy, in its 8th annual iteration. We talk about how the survey came to be. We explore why HR managers are feeling so burned out, how to measure empathy, the optimistic bubble of CEOs, why to hold ideas lightly, and why empathy is not a weakness, despite what CEOs fear. You'll find all the show notes on MinterDial.com, and please do go and drop in a rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show. Ray Shanahan, I'm delighted to have you on. You are the Chief Strategy Officer at Business Solver with two S's. And I have really enjoyed all your work. In your own words, who's Ray?
Oh, I hate talking about myself, Minter.
Oh, well, just make it happen.
But you know what? I just listened to one of your recent podcasts from Dr. Nicole Price. And what really resonated with me is I like to look forward with hope. I like to look backward with gratitude. And I like to look inward with honesty. And really, the best way to describe me is I've been on a lifelong journey of accepting, acknowledging who I am. And part of that journey has been able to spend the last 23 years. So 23 years in 2023 at Business Solver, growing from around 10 employees to, you know, where we are now, around 1500. And it has just been I feel like I've worked for so many different companies and had so many opportunities. So in a nutshell, that's the best way to think about it.
A ray of sunshine.
There you go. Yes.
I love it. So tell us a little bit about Business Solver, because I'm not sure everyone will have heard of you, or what does Business Solver do so we understand better?
Yeah, well, we're a benefits technology company. And the best way to think about us is our focus is on creating a employee experience so that they understand their employee benefits. Think about it as not as an annual enrollment. You know, I know you're in England, so you're not used to this whole benefits thing where you enroll every year, but we've created technology that enables people to access their benefits. And we've transformed it into doing it once a year, so that a way for employees to have access to them throughout the year and get their right benefits at the right place at the right time. And you know, that's what our main focus has been. We haven't tried to be everything to everybody. We've stayed very focused as an organization.
You are definitely also positioning yourself as a thought leader. And one of the things that I understand about what you're trying to do is to enlarge or maybe evolve the notion of benefits.
Yeah. So when we think about the word right, right is not, it's not a one size fits all. Right is really what's best for me. And so as a thought leader, that's why we felt empathy made so much sense as something that we wanted to really magnify. And because benefits are a very personal thing, and that's what empathy is. I can't pick things for you. And just like, I can't know everything that you're thinking about. And part of empathy is being able to think about things from a different and experience things from a different perspective. So that's really the tie between, hey, we're running a business, but empathy is something that we feel very, very passionate about. And you'll hear us say, I'm sure John talked about it when he did the podcast with you a year ago, is that we can't have delighted clients if we don't have delighted employees. And a culture of empathy is really an employee-first culture. So there, I tied it all together. Thought leadership, our business, and our employees.
And we're going to dig back into that a little bit, but it is quite startling to think that people are waking up now to the notion that actually employees deliver the experience.
I think you woke up a long time ago and so did I. How about that? Yeah. I don't know how any organization can truly deliver to their customers if they don't focus on their employees.
Well, you know, I've been observing this from my time at L'Oreal, where we were basically a product-centric company. Very strong financial controls. And then we got into marketing. But the idea of the customer was far away, really. And certainly in our division, even though it was with hairdressers who we loved, but we were really focused on ourselves. And then comes along a company like Amazon that says they want to be the most customer-centric organization on this earth. And I say, well, how does that resonate for the employee? What's the benefit? Speaking of benefits, what's the benefit to be the most customer-centric organization for the employees? How does anyone square that peg?
I think it's a tough one. I would probably turn it to this, that if you are a customer-centric company and you're doing well, then you need to have good employees to support that and to grow as an organization. Growing organizations are good for employees because they have opportunities and organizations can give back in their communities. So that's probably how I'd spin that. But then it goes back to, you can't have a customer-centric organization if you don't have a strong employee culture.
Mm. So I listened to your interview with Maria, a good friend, and talking about the origin of this survey. Mm-hmm. You've been doing for 8 years now. And the idea, as I understood it, was, hey, Edelman is really known for this trust barometer. Mm-hmm. And you ended up on this path with empathy. And what's interesting is that there's all the same quite a relationship between the concepts of trust and empathy. How do you describe that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think trust is a fundamental part of being able to experience empathy. And, you know, I balance that with, another very, very important element is being present. It's something that we as an organization have been focused on is it's so easy to multitask and have all these other things going on, but I can't really get in the moment and experience with another person if I'm not present. So trust builds that ability to be present, to be able to experience empathy.
So I'm curious about the internal shenanigans in the boardroom, about the return on investment of this survey. For having been on boards and this has become, a defining piece as far as I'm concerned. That's how, I mean, there's not a book on empathy that I've read that doesn't quote your research.
Fun.
And to what extent that then rolls back into some kind of return? How do you evaluate that? Do you guys, I assume you're not doing, the old PR method of, I got this quarter of a page here and that's worth 1400 like we used to in the old days.
Well, two things, back to trust. Fortunately, we have a board that absolutely trusts us and trusts us to make the right decisions. And so we don't look for a return on investment that's directly correlated to having an empathy study. We've really used it as an opportunity to really just have some thought leadership and use it not only as a way to hopefully get our brand out a little bit here and there, but as a way for us to use it to learn and continue to evolve as an organization as well.
Yeah, so you're actually, you're evaluating what's happening in the workplace, and you are reflecting also as to how you are shaping your own company with this material. For having written a book on empathy myself, or mm-hmm. Anyone who's written a book about something, that's something becomes something of a halo around your head, or sometimes a lanyard around your neck. And you know, I've been told, well, Minter, that wasn't very empathic of you. So I end up having to uphold a standard that I sometimes can't always do myself. But for you guys, you're living it. And one of the things that I've found interesting in talking to John was that you didn't necessarily always believe that empathy was the big thing.
No, we didn't. So as a practitioner and working, you know, again, in the organization for 23 years, I'd say the first 7 or 8 of them, we were not an empathetic organization. We were a anti-HR. Both John and I started our careers in HR, and we wanted to be, we didn't want to have the traditional HR view. So we didn't have an HR person in our organization until the late 2000s. But where I'm going with this story is we woke up one day. So we had been, we hire people on their first interview. We'd make them an offer right then. We'd hire lots of friends of friends. And not many of us end up getting married and having a long-term relationship with somebody that we met on for one time, right? Right after the one time. Sure, people met on a blind date and they end up getting married. But we were getting, making offers on the spot to people to come to work for us. And what happened is we started to have a darker culture. And it was very much there was drama. There was a lot of fun, very competitive. There was still lots of laughs, but it just had an edge. And then one day I came across a book called Leadership and Self-Deception by the Arpinger Group. And I, before that, would never read any self-help books or any business books. I didn't need any help. I knew what I was doing. And that book hit me really hard. And what the premise of the book is really having an outward mindset. And I said, we need to start to have a very intentional culture. We need to be very deliberate about our hiring. We need to draw a line in the sand and say, we're going to end this culture of meetings after the meeting and drama. And, you know, that's really where we evolved back in 2009, 2010, and really started to have a very, very intentional focus on our employee culture. And, you know, I believe that it, you know, has continued to help fuel our growth, because in 2010, we had around 70 employees. In 2023, we've got about 1,500. And I don't believe we would have been able to have this success and the growth and the joy and the joy that has come with it without having that culture of employee engagement and empathy.
One of the things, Ray, you and I have discussed previously is the challenge or the nature of measuring empathy. And so what I'm getting from you is 2009, the register of empathy was in the zero category. But how do you actually measure or at least evaluate the nature of an empathic culture? How do you guys go about that?
You know, it is a little bit of a Rubik's Cube to really get into evaluating it. But there are some, I think, quantitative things and qualitative things that we do in our organization that I'm happy to share, because I haven't written books, you know, and you've been successful. I've seen you've done, 2,000 blogs, you've done 600 podcasts. You know, I've just been a practitioner and mm-hmm. and with a little Petri dish. So here's a couple of things that we've landed on. We rolled out something that we call the Employee Pulse. And we have a series of 12 questions. I'll just read a couple of them. So this is some of the quantitative data that we ask. So we have, I am connected to the mission and vision of our organization. I feel connected to my leader. I understand how our purpose impacts our business to drive quality results. I'm able to maintain a balance between conflicting priorities. I've received quality feedback from my leader. I feel like my company supports and promotes my well-being. I feel productive. We've added this about working remotely. And employees are able to answer yes, sometimes, rarely, and never. And then we've created so they answer the question. And then we've also created based on the answers to the questions, a calculated color. So they create their color of their pulse. And then We've also done we've created the color. We've made a calculation of the color. So that does two things. Number one, it gives us some data about our employee population and how they're feeling about the organization and what they do. So that's one thing. Another thing is we've created something that we call our common language. It's called our table. So one of them is respond readily. That means being in discovery mode, being prepared to listen. The T is building trust through transparency. The A is assumed positive intent. B is be real. L is live a growth attitude. And E is embrace the reverse golden rule. It's not about the name on the back of the jersey. It's about the name on the front of the jersey. And so by using that common language throughout the organization, it's a way that we're able to communicate with employees. It's a way that we are able to, really have the spirit and intent of those key values in the organization. Want me to keep going? I have a couple more I can share. Do you have questions?
Well, what's interesting, Ray, is that at no point are you actually measuring empathy per se. Mm-hmm. You're circling around it, and you're obviously looking for different indicators. And presumably, it's like the issue I see with some companies and talking about empathy a lot is as soon as you say, oh, we're an empathic organization, or one of our values is empathy, that's almost a red flag saying, ooh, right, maybe you have a problem with empathy, so you're putting it on the table. What level of discussion have you had around this as far as, the narrative, the optics of, we do this survey on empathy, but you don't do a question, which is how empathic is my boss?
Yeah. I don't think there's a calculated reason, Minter. I think internally we embrace empathy. We talk about it. We experience it. But I think there's a number of things that go into really exhibiting it as an organization, both with employees, their families, their clients, and other people that we, our clients and other people that we serve.
One of the challenges with this, and John, CEO Hannah Shanahan, said in the 2023 report that sometimes you make decisions that aren't in the best interests of your employees as a company. They may not even be in the best interests of your clients, of course. That's another story. So in the end of the day, the issue that I've seen is that empathy can never be 100% perfect. And we've gotten into a culture where it's really all about being perfect. Hmm. And if I'm not 100%, you're only 92%? Or some variation of that theme. So the grade of 100% is perfection, and people strive for that somehow. Yet, like relationships, there's the messiness of our relationships. And if we can't have arguments, then it doesn't mean our relationship's not going well. It's actually stronger when we know mm-hmm. how to get through the argument. And so it's messy. So you can't expect to be 100% empathic all the time with everybody everywhere. But we don't want to say that because somehow, you mean you're not empathic? Well, no, I just, we got to do stuff. We have to take hard decisions sometimes. We don't have the time all the time to listen to everybody everywhere. How do you react to that?
Oh, I could go on for a little while. how I react to that is, we're, as an organization, we study different concepts and share different concepts. And right now we're reviewing a book by a guy named Kyle McDowell, Start With We or Begin With We. And he makes it very clear about doing the right thing always. Sometimes it isn't going to be the right thing for the company. It might not be the right thing for the employees. It might not be the right things for the customers. But in the bottom line is, he says, if you don't have an organization, you're not going to have employees. And so sometimes you do have to make some of those hard decisions that are not always right for, not always best for the, each employee might not say, oh, that's great for me. Like, use an example. You can't go and give everybody 200% raises. That's not sustainable for the organization. Employees might like that, but that doesn't mean it's right for the organization. Right. So there is a delicate balance that, and I'll be, I say this over and over again. Empathy is not about always being nice. Empathy is not always about no accountability. And you can have empathy and accountability in an organization.
Hey friends, this is Jim Knight, former 21-year Hard Rock executive turned best-selling author and top 10 keynote speaker.
And I'm Brant Menswar, former frontman of Hollywood's most dangerous band turned top 10 motivational speaker and best-selling author.
We host the how-to podcast Thoughts That Rock, where we talk to rock stars, athletes, CEOs, astronauts, and even next-door neighbors who share their expertise and opinions. Together, we tackle the most interesting and challenging topics of today.
Whether you want to learn how to become more confident, how to deal with anxiety at work,
or how to write a hit song, or use Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in life,
we've got hundreds of episodes to help amp up your life and move you forward.
Subscribe to Thoughts That Rock wherever you listen to podcasts, and check out evergreenpodcast.com for more information.
Absolutely. And the challenge, of course, especially when there's doubt on the horizon, where economics don't play out. And so you don't even have the option of any great raises. And you have the pressure, the shareholder pressure, maybe, that comes down. And, you know, how are you doing this month? And these types of things will, outside of anything else, will stress the senior executive team. Mm-hmm. And stress is... That's a real stress, and mm-hmm. and stress is a real taker away of the ability to be empathic, because you're kind of focused on your own career, and maybe by the end of the month I'm going to be fired, or something else is going to happen. Yeah. So one of the things I think is interesting is that empathy should and can also be a two-way street between the employee and the boss. It seems like there's always this onus on the boss to be empathic. They have the authority somehow. They run the roost. Yet, to what extent can we expect employees to have empathy for a stressed boss? Or is that supposed to be just discarded because that's what you get paid for?
I believe wholeheartedly that it's important for bosses and employees, I hate to use the word bosses, but to have a relationship. And they need, and I think an empathy can be passed up. I can say to somebody that's on a leader's team can ask a leader and talk to a leader about how are you? And, you know, that's something that I think is very important to bring into the organization is leaders need to be authentic. Leaders need to be vulnerable. And it's okay to show that you don't know everything. And you know, people want to feel like they matter. They want to feel like they're supporting something and doing something good. And you need to have a culture where I firmly believe you have to have a culture where you have work relationships. This is a relationship. We spend a lot of time at work, and it's good that we can have open dialogue. And it all starts with leaders have to be. Can't be a fear-based culture, and they have to be able to be vulnerable and not know everything.
It strikes me that year 2009, where you found this darkness and there was a, as I understand it, some sort of level of mea culpa, which in the end of the day is about as vulnerable as you can get as a CEO, because it can be the end of your line if you start saying, I screwed up, I made mistakes. But that presumably allowed for, really was a shift, mm-hmm. step change in the ability for people to say, how are you doing really? And by John's admitting to the situation and the senior team's desire to change, this opened up a whole new way of speaking.
It did. So I'll give you an example. So Wendy Reeves, she's one of our longtime employees. This was I think the kind of the truly the moment that I said this has to stop. So she had started and back then I talked about we didn't do any HR. So we wrote offer letters on Napkins. I think hers was on a gum wrapper. And, you know, Wendy, excited you're going to join us. Something about, you know, forgive us for all warts and freckles. Let me know how you're doing. And she, the first few months, she was, oh, this is so awesome. I love it. It's just, oh, we're growing so fast and this is amazing. And then a couple of months later, she quit. And I'm like, Wendy, what's up? You said you're going to come talk to me if things weren't going well. And she's like, well, Ray, I don't know. You know, sometimes I'm so glad we're growing, but we're growing too fast. And I don't feel like I'm a good mom, but I'm having a lot of fun. And, you know, I don't have any balance. And you could see that she was kind of illogical in that comment. And so I said, okay. And she left. And then about a year later, we were having an open house. We'd redone the office and it looked nice. And she came in and she's like, Ray, Patrick wanted me to ask you if you would hire me back. And I said, say that again, Wendy. You know, she continued. And then, and I said, well, why? And she said, Patrick said that even though I was working hard, he said that I was a better spouse, a happier, better mother. I was happier all around and felt that I should ask to come back. And at that moment I said, you know what? We can do this. We can be the positive place. Let's focus on the things that we're really good at. And you know, that's kind of where things started.
Patrick being your husband, I'm guessing.
Yeah, Patrick being your husband.
Yeah. So in your report, there's so much in your report that I mm-hmm. of course, anyone who's listening has to go read. There'll be show notes for that. One of the things that is clearly tough, and it's funny, it's sort of ironic, I think, that you know you eschewed HR at some level, but this report focuses on the mm-hmm. human resources. And it's at the one hand, there's this deficit of evaluation of empathy. There's also this huge rise in mental health and descriptions of burnout. And for me, at some level, I'm thinking sometimes we try to do good too much. And that trying to strive for the proper, the best, the politically correct, the 100% is such an unachievable stress that also has been provoking A, burnout, and B, mental health.
You know, I think you've heard me talk about holding the concept of holding our ideas lightly. And that's how I feel about the 100. That's how I feel about the 100% is it's not feasible. It sets us up for failure. And is that the ego that is getting in the way, thinking that you need to be at the 100%? And how do we take the pressure off that you don't have to be at 100%. And I agree that that's weighing on when we think about the different generations in the workplace, it's a difficult concept. And you know, the only thing I can think of is making it okay. It's okay to fail. It's okay to make mistakes. It's just not okay to make them over the same one over and over and over again.
Right.
And, you know, organizations can talk a good game about that. But it's an important thing to be able to reinforce.
Yeah, and presumably model it at least in mm-hmm. the beginning to say, hey, some days I come in, I'm feeling shit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can do that, then that gives the sort of, it pops the bubble. I suppose you might refer to that as the optimistic bubble.
Yeah.
At some level, you know, during this whole COVID pandemic story where, for certain companies and sectors, it was mandated to work remote. So there wasn't a choice. You just had to buckle down and make it happen. Now we have a choice. and even during the pandemic, the number of times I observed or listened or heard a CEO say, well, it's not that tough for me, you know, and then open brackets, well, because I get to go to my country home where I have three dogs and I get to walk with them and I have a huge living room and there's just the two of us living in a huge house, close brackets, you know, and they don't have any relationship or understanding of how the life is in remote work. On the other hand, now we have the choice. And when there's choice, you have to get enrollment. You have to think about how you're going to structure the business. And which is the right mix. And it feels like HR is caught in the middle.
Yeah, it completely does. You know, I think you saw in the results from our survey, what in 2022, 91% of HR professionals viewed their organization as empathetic. And in 2023, that number dropped to 68%. Huh. And part of this is, I think a lot, my personal opinion in reading through the data is a lot of this is tied to the HR professionals are stuck in the middle of a kind of a yin and a yang about, they were, you know, helping people, staffing for remote, hiring different people. And then we have so many of these, the CEOs are ordering their people, employees back into work, and they're stuck now saying, I have integrity. If we think about HR, I mean, they, you know, they're probably the most empathic people. They are the most, tend to be the most thoughtful in the organization too about the people needs. So they went and hired all these people and gave them opportunities to work anywhere they wanted. And now, you know, then there's a sudden turn and, you know, they hired those people with integrity we're going to work remote. And now they're stuck in the middle of having to tell the people, sorry, we're going to count your badge swipes. And you have to be back in the office. And I'm sorry that you moved and sold your car, but you're still reported back in the office. And, you know, they're stuck having to fulfill those I don't want to call mandates that come from some of the CEOs.
One of the things that I picked up about how you guys run the business at Business Solver is also some level of transparency about the business itself. And it's quite amazing how little, certainly in my time at L'Oreal, I was there for 16 years, we would spend any level of conversation around how the business was actually going or how any other parts of the business, you just got to do your business on your job and get that done. And yet the context in which we're working, in the old days, we sort of thought every year we had to do 10% growth, just come shit or shine. That's what had to happen. But what is difficult is making a hard decision and making people getting enrollment for that decision and using, if you're not able to do it, look yourself in the mirror as a CEO and give a solid explanation without feeling either condescending or some other type of unappreciable management style. What we need to do is help them understand why you're making that decision. And then that two-way empathy starts to come into place.
Yeah. Context helps people understand. They may or may not agree, but it at least helps them understand that there's thoughts behind those kinds of decisions. And John and I both agree, as well as the rest of the executive team, that there's nothing more important that we can do than to make sure that our employees understand the business, understand what's going on and how they fit in to what's going on in the business. We commit to every Monday morning at 8:30 Central, we call it What's Going On. And we highlight a different part of the business, monthly share results, highlight, you know, different activities that we have on we call it our Solver Nation calendar, opportunities for employees to engage. And then we celebrate the people's successes. And, you know, I think we've missed it three times since the beginning of the pandemic. And it's just built a different level of interaction with our employees too. In the office, people were more intimidated and less comfortable talking to some of the senior leaders. And it's almost like the pandemic has helped us kind of have a level playing field. We are all seen from shoulders up. It's easier to interact with more employees. When you're in offices and you have multiple places, it's very difficult to necessarily have interactions that are, you know, that are meaningful. And we've just really seen that employees are grateful for getting to hear what's going on across the business and grateful that we're willing to share.
So in the idea of of creating a more empathic culture. And there's a lot of expectations that are coming from the younger people that you identify. Mm-hmm. But if the expectations are too much, then the business is going to go under, because we're trying to solve all these expectations. There needs to be a level of, at least, I want to say, pushback to understanding. And something you talk about is having open dialogue. The pre-prep work for that is to have the trust as well. Because if I want to be explaining that we have to cut workforce, or we have to do something that doesn't sound so hot, to do that in a way that is not meeting expectations is part of that tricky balance that you have to match.
You know, I go back to one of the phrases that always sticks with me from Brené Brown, which is clear is kind. And, you know, I had to let an employee go a while ago, because it's still important to have performance. And I view
that accountability.
And if you've been clear on what your expectations are, you can still maintain dignity when it's not the right place for someone. And you can have, and, you know, this person was thankful for the dialogue, understood. And it doesn't mean that they're not good people. It just isn't the right place and right time. And we're never as clear and memorable as we think we are in conversations. And, you know, so one of the things that, you know, I stress with people is, does that person really know? Would they be surprised if I asked them how they're doing? Would they be surprised if I went to them and said, did you know you're almost out the door? And, you know, if they, most of the time, most people, because nobody wants to have that directive feedback, but as leaders, that's what we have to be able to be clear and again, not be afraid to sometimes repeat ourselves, because again, we're never as memorable as we think we are.
Well, the expression that I basically co-opted from a friend and a mentor for me, Pat Parenti, is to be fair and firm. Mm. And that's that notion of clarity. Of course, if you don't have that clarity within you as a leader, then that's where the problem begins. So we have these situation where you have these HR people that are burning out. We have this over-appreciation of ourselves, an over-appreciation of the clarity of what I'm saying, an over-appreciation of how empathic I am. What sort of, you know, I assume that out of your survey, the work you're doing, you're also having to educate your clients. At least they can't just sit on that and say, oh my gosh, you know, we're bad. Now, how do I get back into this? Because I can't just give up to all the expectations. I still need to run the business. I still need this accountability. I still need this performance.
Well, hopefully there's a few data points that can help them have a conversation. You know, one of the things that we talk to our clients about is data doesn't tell the story. You need to use the data to be data informed and to be able to have a story. And so, you know, sometimes when we think about our HR professionals, they, you know, helping them be a more strategic conversation at the table, and using data to be able to drive that dialogue, you know, with I think what was one of the data points? I'm gonna look at my notes. So CEO said 63% said that the return to office has positively impacted their mental health, while only 39% of professionals say the same. You know, there's some real stories there that can show where there is the divide. And in that divide, there's an opportunity to help them build a bridge. And so hopefully the survey and some of the data points, especially about the expansion of the definition of what employees think benefits are. You know, I think 96 or 7% said having a flexible work schedule was an important benefit. Many of our traditional HR people don't think about that as a benefit. They think about health and welfare and those kinds of things as benefits.
And don't they also, I assume, attach to each of those benefits a dollar value? This is like your insurance package. This is your, you know, sports, whatever it's called, you know.
Fitness club.
Yep. Yeah. So that, oh, that's going to be $14 per month per employee and a flexibility. Well, what's the cost of that?
So many times organizations create policies that they want to treat everybody the same, requiring everybody back in 3 days a week, the same 3 days, or you need to have four badge swipes. And sometimes those decisions are to deal with a few outliers. And sometimes I think sometimes those blanket policies are more cowardly because they don't want to deal with the hard conversations. And, you know, I believe that, you know, back to the whole trust conversation, let's give employees that flexibility. Let's trust them to do the right thing. Let's trust them to do their work as they need to and deal with the outliers again, rather than applying the same rule to everyone.
Blanket stuff. So last question for you, Ray. You've been doing this survey for 8 years. The drop in perception of empathy at a company has dropped down. I was wondering, and there is one statistic which I have to throw out there, which is that CEOs continue to worry that being empathic is a sign of weakness. To what extent, you know, that's a crazy one. I want you to comment that one. And to what extent do you believe that people are understanding empathy more, since the subject of empathy is now so much more present, regularly talked about, written in many books? Your survey has become well known. Do you feel like people are actually understanding empathy better or not?
I do think people are understanding empathy. You know, when I was reading through your book, it's artificial. What is it? Artificial empathy?
Artificial empathy. Yeah.
Artificial empathy. It was fun to see the Google search from, you know, what, early 2000s all the way to here and to see the steady line. So I have to believe that, you know, repetition is the motor of learning and seeing it more, hearing it more, there's more knowledge and awareness. Does that mean people in this divisive world we're in are empathic as they think they are? You know, I don't think our survey judges that at this point. And, you know, it's exciting to see the energy around it. And I believe that it is, that the energy around it is making a difference.
Well, I am delighted by that, Ray. We're a bunch of empathy activists, and we consider you guys almost flag bearers for us who are each trying to fight in our own way. And what I appreciate about the way you speak, Ray, is that, well, first of all, you feel it's personal. And two, you don't express it as some sort of dogma. It is a work in progress. It has to be ups and downs. And sometimes you don't have the time or the mindset. And we need to allow for that type of imperfection. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, and you talked about treating your employees as adults. Absolutely. The more you try to control them and operate by a system of fear, unless and no information, the less likely you're going to get anything back. So anyway, bravo to you guys at Desasaur. Bravo. Thank you so much, Ray, for coming on my show and talking about this. And I'll put any show notes. What would you like? Where would you like people to go following this chat?
Follow us as an organization on LinkedIn, as well as that's, if you want to, I'll post every once in a while, and then, you can learn more about our organization, at businesssolver.com with two S's in the middle, like you said, Minter. I think John regrets that he didn't put three S's in there at the very beginning, but, it's too late to change that now.
It is what it is. And you're becoming known. Sometimes the little mistakes, can be good. So that's my feeling about, you know, the things we do. You rewrite the story.
There you go.
Thank you very much, Ray.
Thanks, Minter. Enjoyed it.
Thanks for having listened to this episode of the Minter Dialogue podcast. If you like the show, would like to support me, please consider a donation on patreon.com/MinterDial. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast service. And as ever, rating and reviews are the real currency for podcasts. You'll find the show notes with over 2,000 or more blog posts on MinterDial.com. Check out my documentary film and 4 books, including my last one, You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust is the reason, still I won't tell the lie. I sit here passively, hope for your respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, building an urge. I'm a convinced man, to live and die submerged. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, competition's innate. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. Despise revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, put me to the test. I'm a convinced man,
I'm ready for an arrest.
I'm a convinced man, in the arms of a woman.
Hello, this is Gary Chachot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.